Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and today I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
And our News Editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And this week, we're returning to cinemas for an event movie.
Ah,
round goes wild. So yes, we will be assessing Christopher Nolan's Tenet, spoiler-free, of course, and that opened this week. Plus, we'll be talking to Bill Nighy about his marriage split drama, Hope Gap, and we'll be assessing Xavier Dolan's latest Matthias et Maxine, as well as Animation Away. But first up, we probably should talk about a whole load of amazing trailers and artwork that dropped at the DC FanDome this week. What are you most excited about? I mean, there's some awesome stuff coming out of that.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the obvious answer, but Matt Reeves' The Batman looks absolutely incredible. I mean, we got a first teaser trailer, even though they've actually shot, I think they said about 25% of that film, and it still looked better than most trailers I've ever seen.
I know, right? It's like, it seems like they shot all the good stuff already, because that looks pretty amazing.
Yeah, I just thought it looked awesome. I'm totally sold on Robert Pattinson as Batman already. I love the aesthetic of it. I love some of the brief glimpses of action in it. The seeming glimpse of Paul Dano's The Riddler. He looks really cool. Yeah, I'm all in on the Batman.
Yeah,
I've had Something in the Way by Nirvana in my head ever since as well.
I know. It was just achingly cool, wasn't it? Even the suit and the artwork that came out with the suit that's got these like new shoulder pads and the gauntlets, and it just looks much more sort of cool. It's hard to say that, obviously, when you think about Nolan's being the last iteration of it, but it does look fresh and it does look cool.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing achievement already.
That's what I was most impressed by, because I am a bit of a Batman fanboy, I must say. And
I
love the Dark Knight trilogy most of all. And so I'm always slightly nervous as to what's going to follow that. But I did think, wow, this managed to kind of carve out some fresh space and didn't just feel like it was redoing that or redoing anything that we've seen on film before. And I loved how it did feel so kind of true to those like late 80s comics as well. Just loved that whole vibe to it. But I did actually think it was a pretty great event all round.
Pretty good lineup,
Comic-Con was a bit of a damp squib this year, but like I thought the Suicide Squad look we got from James Gunn, that was very cool, and it was just very exciting just to finally learn who all those many actors are actually playing in the film. That looks great.
And obviously old Wonder Woman looking fabulous.
Great new trailer and poster for that. Like, I'm much more excited about the Flash film than ever thought I would have been, largely because obviously multiple Batmans in it, but you know, the new suit, I think I wasn't a big fan of his suit in Justice League, so I like the fact they've gone for a sleeker, sort of shinier suit now.
Yeah, I don't think it's been officially announced by DC, but there are rumblings that Batfleck is going to be in The Flash and Michael Keaton's Batman, which could be mind-blowing if they pull off a satisfying story involving multiple Batmen. And we got that little bit of concept art from The Flash as well, which appeared to have Keaton's Batman in the background, which set my fanboy klaxon ringing. I was very excited by that.
It's like Into the Spider-Verse, but with Batman, basically.
I know, it's everything you could possibly
want. I'm all in on that.
And then you've also got Black Adam and other stuff that's going on. So it just felt really exciting. And as I think you said, Matt, earlier this week, it feels like Marvel are like left hanging a bit. This is has been a great showcase. So when are we going to get a Marvel version of this? Because we want to know what they've got in store, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, Marvel would traditionally come out at Comic-Con. That's usually their big showcase for the year. So I don't know if COVID set them back a little bit, but it feels like they should be ready to announce things or drop things now. They must surely be wanting to do that. You know, they're very good at engaging with fans. So I can imagine they have something similar in the works.
Yeah. We need like an Eternals trailer or like first look or something to kind of fight back against this. Like, come on, like surely this has like spurred them on to drop that.
Well, it's technically not too long till Black Widow, so we will get our Marvel fix soon.
She is coming. Okay, so let's just move on quickly then from our lovely comic book hurrah to a reader's question just before we get stuck into just a little film called Tenet. So the reader's question is, if you could own one prop from a movie, what would it be?
There are a lot of things from my favorite films I'd love to decorate my house with. I've often thought it'd be fun to have the Voight Kampff machine from Blade Runner on the table in my living room.
Awesome.
Just to check that, you know, my visitors aren't replicants there to poke my eyes out or something. And I've long had a dream of owning a pulse rifle from Aliens, just because it's the coolest movie weapon of all time. Don't know what I'd do with it. Maybe just bond over my partner, teaching her how to use the grenade launcher or something.
Nice.
As a kid, I was obsessed with Ghostbusters, like a lot of kids. And I actually did get like a toy proton pack and a ghost trap, which I used to run around the house and pretend to capture my sister with. So owning the actual prop, like an actual ghost trap, would be a neat kind of full circle moment for me.
Did you have that ghost trap that you sort of pumped open with the...
Yeah.
Sort
of, you kind of rolled it on the floor and then it had a pump and it just, the flaps opened.
Yeah.
And it was very underwhelming, but, you know...
not to your child self, it wasn't.
Exactly. It was the coolest thing I've ever seen.
What about you, Matt?
There's absolutely loads of stuff I'd be tempted with. The thing that first sprung to mind, though, was I'd go for some kind of really cool movie puppet, like probably, if I had to narrow it down, probably Gizmo from Gremlins. If I could have just like an original Gizmo. Like, I've got a little Gizmo teddy, but, you know, if I had like a real one from the film that I could like tuck in at night, that would be my number one choice.
Make your wife sort of pull its legs so that it talks to you. Just live the life of it. Yeah, okay.
And how about you, Jane? What prop would you have?
I mean, for me, it has to be the golden idol from Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'd want that.
Ooh.
Just sitting on my shelves as a antiquity. I'd also love to own Dorothy's red shoes and hope I could squeeze my feet into them and click my heels. That would be great. So yeah, those are my two. There's probably props that we might like to own in the next film. Shall we have a look at what we're talking about this week? First up, we have one word for you.
All I have for you is a word. Tenet. It'll open the right doors, some of the wrong ones too.
You have to start looking at the world in a new way.
Don't try to understand it. Feel it.
So this is Christopher Nolan's Tenet. I mean, it's probably an impossible task, but Matt, do you want to try and tell us what it's about?
Well, Jordan had this tough task last week, so we spoke about it a little bit at the end of our Christopher Nolan countdown on last week's pod. If we're trying to keep it spoiler-free, we'll stick to just what you might have seen in trailers. Basically, this film, obviously the latest film from Christopher Nolan, a huge espionage blockbuster, and it follows a protagonist played by John David Washington from BlacKkKlansman. And right at the very beginning, he's involved in this big terrorist incident. And then afterwards, he faces a huge kind of personal test of how long he can survive a torture, basically, without giving up his colleagues. And then he awakes after that with a mysterious guy played by Martin Donovan, introducing him to the concept of Tenet and this new mission he's going to have to face. It's up to him from then on to just follow the threads that, you know, he finds from this word Tenet. And it leads him to this Anglo-Russian national played by Kenneth Branagh, and it also leads him to the concept of time inversion, which is sort of like time travel but not quite. And I don't even know if it's worth me attempting to try and explain that now.
I
also think it is a thrill of the film, kind of seeing it unfold and seeing what they do with it. That's not a spoiler to say, you learn about that, you know, 10 minutes into the film. From then on, it's just this huge mission that kind of encompasses heists, enormous set pieces, going undercover, car chases, fights, and kind of loads more, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's best to know nothing, really, going into this. And, you know, arguably some people would say coming out of it, you'll be no more enlightened. That has been a sort of criticism of the film. It is incredibly complicated and labyrinthine and all of those words that people will use against it. But at the same time, I think it's properly thrilling to not be able to second guess anything that's coming down the line. I mean, obviously, we're not going to talk about specifics here because we don't want to do spoilers. We will be doing that in a special spoiler podcast. But I mean, what can we talk about as the really great things that are going on in this film? Jordan, what did you love about it?
Well, the absolute highlights for me are, of course, the remarkable kind of set piece moments that Nolan's put together. I mean, he's a master of those huge cinematic moments. He filmed this in full frame IMAX 70mm, so it looks absolutely incredible. Everything from simple establishing shots of these remarkable Italian cliff faces and Mumbai skyscrapers to the fact that he took an actual 747 airplane and crashed it into a hangar, which blew my mind. But even then, he's such an inventive filmmaker that a moment where he crashes an actual plane just feels like a minor moment compared to some of the stuff you actually get to see later on. It's just so inventive. Everything he does with this central conceit of time inversion, I just thought was absolutely ingenious. And I just have no idea how you would even go about planning that and putting it on screen. I thought it was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, when you watch it, you do think the logistics of this film, you know, films are not made in order. Ordinarily, they're sort of quite difficult to understand if you're on set and you're filming something one day and something completely different from the end of the film and the next day and then at the beginning. So imagine trying to keep that storyline in order. It's amazing. It's a bravado sort of thing for him to have pulled off, and his team, amazing cast. Let's talk about that cast a bit more. Obviously, John David Washington, you mentioned as our protagonist. He's so cool in this, isn't he? I just was thinking, when is Barbara Broccoli giving him a call? What did you think?
Yeah, he is very cool. I've actually, again, now that reviews are out, I've seen a few kind of criticisms saying he's a bit of a blank character, but I think he is just the kind of character you want to carry you through this. And as sort of Nolan had said as much beforehand, but because John David Washington himself, he's so kind of likable and he's got this kind of cheeky swagger to him as well.
Really does, yeah.
You do just want to stick with him. So like, even if he doesn't have a huge arc in himself, he's someone you really kind of sense his conviction and you really want to just, yeah, like run alongside him as he's kind of throwing himself into this ever kind of evolving mission. And yeah, you just and really want to root for him the whole time as well.
He sort of provides some levity as well, doesn't he? I mean, he has some quite sort of Bondian exchanges with people, you know, has a particularly nasty conversation with Kenneth Branagh's character at one point, who makes all sorts of threats, and his sort of response to that is very sort of cool and nonchalant. And I also think that works really well with Robert Pattinson, who is his sort of sidekick in this, Neil, this mysterious man that sort of appears next to him, ordering him a Coke and telling him that's what he likes to drink, who becomes this confidant and sidekick, and there's sort of this Butch and Sundance running through this film. He's also very funny as well. I loved their relationship playing out against what is essentially this incredibly serious situation. What we're talking about is worse than a nuclear holocaust. That's how it's described. The coming of World War III, of just absolute horror. So it's like your mission is extremely serious, and yet they managed to have bants and make it funny as well. I loved it. And yes, I also love that within that, they have these amazing sequences, two different sort of heist sequences that are just breathtaking to watch. And one of them, you literally are holding your breath with them because they have to hold their breath for reasons we won't go into. Just really enjoyed watching the two of them move through this world.
Yeah, the surprise bromance of the year. Yeah. John David Washington and Robert Pattinson. But also, I thought Kenneth Branagh was exceptionally good in this film as well. He's a really loathsome villain. I really just despised him from the moment
horrible.
He walked on screen.
Yeah.
Which you often don't say about Sir Ken, because he's a seemingly quite a nice chap. But he does like really slimy, horrible Russian bad guy extremely well in this film.
Naturally menacing. I mean, some lines he has to deliver where he threatens to do things to John David Washington's nether regions that could be ridiculous said by the wrong person, but he delivers them and you actually fully believe that that's going to happen. Yeah, I thought it was actually quite a surprising performance from him. We sort of got used to Ken as a Hercule Poirot or as a director of Artemis Fowl, let's not mention that one. But here you actually see, oh my God, he's a great actor. I'd sort of forgotten that.
I could see him getting nominations if we end up having awards this year.
Yeah, totally. And also let's talk about Elizabeth Debicki as this very regal wife. She's sort of presented as a Hitchcock blonde in the way she's dressed and her hair. She's this very glacial woman that appears to not have any feelings but unravels as the story goes along. Did you think she was like a token lady, or did you feel like she was contributing a great deal to the story?
Me and Jordan slightly disagree on this, I think, because I'll let Jordan say his thing after. But well, I can see why the damsel comments come up, because she doesn't get involved in any of the kind of biggest action scenes. But I do think she has quite a pivotal arc to the story and has the kind of deepest character really out of all those four main players, I would say. So which kind of offset it a bit for me, but I know Jordan feels slightly differently.
I don't feel completely differently, because practically all of the emotional heavy lifting is put on her shoulders in this film. You know, quite deliberately, John David Washington's character, the protagonist, and Neil, Robert Pattinson's characters, are both kept enigmas throughout most of the film, so you never really learn a great deal about them. So all of the emotional storytelling comes on the side of Elizabeth Debicki's cat. because she has a son, and that's sort of a central part of the film as well. So I thought she did a really good job with what she was given. There's a lot of, like, you know, cry acting, and there's a lot of very heavy lifting going on from her part. I really wanted her to get more involved in the story on the sort of action level, because it just felt to me like a lot of the time she was just along for the ride, too often having to be saved rather than, you know, driving the action herself, when it felt like she was so closely involved with everything that was going on a lot of the time. It felt like there was a real opportunity for her to actually do something, when too often she didn't, for me.
You know, she does have a key aspect which I would argue against that, Jordan. So we'll talk about that in our spoiler podcast. Let's talk let's talk about the cinematography and the sound of this. The sound design and the music is chef's kiss. It is Christopher Nolan at his very best. This thrumming, insistent score. It's really loud. If you see it in an IMAX, it's all, like, all-encompassing. It's amazing. Do you not think this is exactly, you know, like, why you go to the cinema, to sort of have this eye-popping spectacle with this sound?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually a different composer this time, of course, Ludwig Göransson, who scored The Mandalorian and Black Panther, as opposed to Hans Zimmer, who's done pretty much all of Nolan's films in recent years. And I think he does an exceptional job. It's a slightly Zimmer-esque score for him.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have pegged it as a different composer if I didn't know, quite possibly. But he also does really interesting things with the score, I thought. You know, the whole film plays with this concept of time in ways that we're not going to go into here. But the score does as well, in that, yes, really fun and interesting ways. Because there are kind of moments where the score is kind of flip-flopping about and you're like, oh, I can see what you've done there. Mm-hmm. But it's very propulsive. It very much puts you in the moment. The opening sequence of the film, which some people will have already seen as it screened before screens of The Rise of Skywalker, it's kind of soundtracked. There's very little dialogue in the whole thing, so it relies almost completely on the score. And I thought that whole opening sequence is just so intense.
Yes.
I could just feel like all my internal organs kind of rattling in the cinema.
Yeah.
It was really like sort of breathtaking in the truest sense of the word.
It's like a Bond cold open, isn't it? A pre-title sequence. It's really like, what's going on? Where are we? Who is this guy? Oh my God, what is happening? It's really super exciting.
It was actually really interesting as well, a press conference I attended last week for Tenet, and they were just talking about the music and basically saying that they don't ever use kind of temp tracks like they kind of do on other films, where they'll kind of use existing music, you know, to set a scene as they're kind of doing it or when they're first looking at it, and that how much they kind of built it from the ground up, sort of together, basically, in tandem. That made me think, looking back on it, yeah, it really feels so entwined with the film. It just doesn't feel like a kind of different layer that's just been plonked on top. It feels like essentially part of the whole experience.
So are we recommending people go and see this? There's been wildly different reviews for it and scoring systems. We've given it 5 stars because we think it's event cinema that you need to see and be part of the conversation. What do you think? Do you think it's going to be frustrating for some folk?
Yeah, I think some people will come out feeling confused. I've still only seen this film once, and there are still elements of it that I'm still trying to get my head around. But I do quite strongly believe that it probably will make sense after it's all settled. So if you give it a chance, it will absolutely satisfy, I believe.
And Matt, you've seen it twice.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I've seen it twice. Yeah, it's a hard recommend for me. I'm going to go and see it a third time as well this weekend. But I would just advise that don't go in switching your brain off expecting, like, you know, a Saturday night popcorn movie in that sense. In the classic Nolan tradition, there's no kind of concessions made to people who aren't going to keep up. Like, certain things are mentioned once in passing and you need to just be fully focused the whole time, you know, and just don't ever, like, you know, let your concentration slip or...
Yeah, don't go in drunk. You'll never follow it.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, no pre-Tenet beers.
No, have a cocktail.
But I also think that for all these kind of criticisms it's faced about how complex it is, there's something about the storytelling and the way Nolan does it, and also what we're saying about the way you just want to follow John David Washington the whole time as well, that it's so kind of propulsive and there's so much momentum that you are kind of carried through the film, even if you couldn't, you know, there's times where, you know, you may not fully be able to kind of explain the science and things like that. For me, if you like this kind of cinema, there's not going to be any moments where you're not enjoying it and you're not going to come out so befuddled that you're like, oh, what was that? You still understand the gist of it and the sort of...
And even if you don't understand it, you know, a character does say, you know, don't think, just feel. If you just go and just let it wash over you, the experience of it and the visuals and everything else, even if you haven't a clue what's going on, I think you'd still enjoy it. It does take you all around the world, to Oslo, to Capri, and it's a real sort of exotic adventure, and that's what we're craving at the moment. So I think even on that level, it would be really entertaining.
Tom Cruise gave it a thumbs up. So
Tom Cruise did. You know, come on. The cruiser likes it. So there's your recommendation. Okay, so that is Tenet, which is out in cinemas now. And don't forget, we will have a spoiler podcast. We'll be talking every single plot detail in that. And we'll see if we do understand what's going on. Maybe we don't. Okay, so Tenet aside, it's time to move on to other films that are out this week. Shall we move on to our guest this week? It's Bill Nighy, who's in Hope Gap.
I'm going to leave. She'll be better off without me.
I don't want to be here when you do it.
You can't just walk away after 29 years. You have to try.
I have tried for 29 years.
No.
So that was a clip from Hope Gap, and I'm delighted to be joined by the film star, Bill Nighy. Bill, welcome to Inside Total Film.
Pleasure. Hello.
You've got a new film coming out, Hope Gap. So would you be able to set it up in a nutshell for anyone who hasn't seen it yet?
It's a contemporary film about a marriage, and it's a film that examines the difficulties of being married, staying married, the challenges of leaving a marriage, and discusses, I suppose, the morality of that, and whether or not you're ever at liberty to be the author of so much pain. That doesn't sound like much of a night out, and I'm fully aware of that, but it does have, apart from the fact the script was very, very beautifully written, was the fact that I got to work with Annette Bening, who is the great American actress who plays my wife in the film, and you get to see Annette Bening acting at length, which is always one of the great joys of the cinema going. And people who have seen it, it's that thing about tragedy. I don't think this qualifies quite as tragedy, but it's that thing about, you know, where films which discuss things which sometimes make us sad, but actually when you leave the cinema, it's weirdly uplifting. But I think it's simply because the quality of the writing and hopefully the performances bring you to some further revelation about life and relationships and love and the human experience, not to put too fine a point on it.
And you've obviously worked on some huge blockbusters in your time. And is the experience for you as an actor very different when you're working on a film that's as small and intimate as this?
Well, yes. I mean, only in terms of the external things, like the set is bigger, like you're possibly working on a galleon, you know, on a night shoot in the Caribbean, with rain machines, you know, things like that. So, I mean, the actual specifics are different sometimes, but the job remains the same, which is that when somebody says action, you have to speak and act as if you've never spoken the words before and as if you've never quite acted in that way before. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the basic work is the same, except the surroundings are very different.
And how did you find writer-director William Nicholson to work with?
Very, very good to work with. Very super prepared. He'd waited a long time to make this film. The good thing about this particular job, and it's always good, if you get a chance to rehearse, rehearsal costs money, so often it's not the case. And there's a kind of reckless thing of where you meet in a field or on a ship or in a kitchen in Doncaster and say, hi, how are you? And then somebody says action, because they couldn't afford any rehearsal time. But on this one, we did get some rehearsal. And it makes a huge difference, so that people are all on the same page by the time you turn over. And therefore, he left us alone to a large degree, having said his piece during the rehearsal period and taken us through every single line and every single scene and declaring his intentions kind of thing. There was not a lot of necessity for great discussion on the set. And when you're working with people like Josh and Annette, who are exemplary in terms of professionalism, they could speak their part backwards if they were absolutely required to. You know, they're not waiting for some mythical lightning to strike on the set, you know what I mean? They've actually done the work, and therefore, you know, it was a very happy set, and it was very satisfying, and Bill would leave us alone to a great degree unless there was something very specific that he needed, you know. Mostly we just did two or three takes of everything, and as long as all departments were happy, we moved on, you know.
And kind of on paper, there's a risk that your character could have seemed like a villain, because he's obviously the one who's doing the leaving of this marriage, but that's not the case at all. Like, did you kind of discuss that at all with Bill about how that might play out?
I think we did. You know, they do say don't make any judgments about your character, because it's not useful. Let the audience do that. Like for any part. In this particular part, as you suggest, it is an obvious consideration. And people will have their own view. You know, it's a very, very, very controversial thing. You know, there will be a lot of people who will say that nobody has the right to do what he did. And there will be lots of other people who've done it. You know, half the world, apparently, I think the statistic is something like 50-50, half the world have done it, and they will have another view or not, whatever. You know, it's one of those things. It's not a case of who's the villain. It's more complex than that, yeah. I think. I mean, obviously, people always look to see who's right, who's wrong, who's to blame, who's not to blame, you know, which side are you on, which is part of the problem in the first place. I don't think it's useful certainly not in terms of relationships. The blame game is not always productive. I tried just to tell the story, you know, and play my part as honestly as it's written. And then the audience can make up their mind.
During that rehearsal process you spoke of, working with Josh O'Connor, did you two kind of work together to share physical sort of mannerisms between father and son? Because that's something that came across on screen. I wondered how much kind of that was something you intentionally worked on.
Yeah, I think that will be Josh, because he's a cunning artist. He would have stolen a few of my moves, my shapes. I didn't discuss it with him, but I'm sure he did. I have many sons in my career now. In fact, I have grandsons now. I always look around at some point and they're studying me. And you think, oh, I see. You're on the prowl. You're looking for things to use. So I should imagine, yeah, I'm pretty sure that you did, yeah. Other people said that.
Who are some of your favourite on-screen sons that you've had in the past?
I've had many that I've been very fond of. In recent times, Sam Riley was my son in Sometimes Always Never, which was very, very pleasant. Donald Gleason was a great son to have in About Time, you know. I've been father to great men. Now I've upset the ones I haven't mentioned, but I hope not. You know, I've had some very distinguished sons.
And you're obviously someone who's known for your sartorial style. Did you manage to maintain a commitment to that during the lockdown period, or like the rest of us, were you in jogging bottoms and dressing gowns the whole time?
I've never had jogging bottoms, as you might have suspected. And if you see me in jogging bottoms anytime soon, just call a cab, because I'm obviously in trouble. I've maintained a reasonable standard of what you might call modernist casual wear. I don't sort of dress down because I'm not going out. You know, if I didn't get up in the morning and shave and do everything and put on something that would be fine, you know, if I was in the high street, then I'm going to feel unhappy. And the thing about wearing suits or whatever, I remember somebody asked Jarvis Cocker, why did he wear a suit all the time? I don't know if he wears a suit all the time, but basically he's like me, he's a jacket person. Jarvis said, because you never know who you're going to bump into, which I thought was a pretty good answer. I mean, mind you, in this situation, of course, I'm not going to bump into anyone. If you'd have told me that I would have ever FaceTimed anyone, I would have called you a liar. But I've now spent 6 months or something regularly FaceTiming people. And I'm not one of those people that can put a decent shirt on and have shorts on underneath or something. It's an aesthetic thing. I mean, it's the same for lots of people. It's why fashion is one of the biggest industries in the world. Even people who affect not to care, they affect not to care with such meticulous, you know, commitment that you realize that, you know, they're just doing the same thing as everybody else, except they're trying to pull that thing, you know, I'm so wild and free that I don't care. But you try and put them in the wrong jumper and they'll kill you. You know?
That's very true. As a final one to wrap up on, Bill, now that kind of obviously more films are coming out, what do you think we're going to see you in next?
What are you going to see me in next? I've got plans. I won't say what they are right now. But keep an eye out, because there could be something good in the new year. But it won't be for a while, and I don't want to say anything. I don't know if they're officially announced yet, so I better shut up. I don't want to get into trouble.
That's fair enough. Bill, it's been really great to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure, Matt.
We obviously reviewed Hope Gap in a previous podcast, so if you want to know if that's worth your money, do seek that out. But Hope Gap is now in cinemas on the 28th of August. And it's also on Curzon Home Cinema. So have a little look at that. Okay, from a couple falling out of love to a couple falling into love. Let's look at this.
Normal.
Avant longtemps, j'ai l'intention de te donner un peu plus d'importance ici.
Je pense que ça va me faire du bien l'Australie.
Qu'est-ce que tu en vas faire là-bas?
Je sais pas. Changer d'air. Ça me suis dû.
Puis ta mère, mettons.
C'est des nouvelles de ton frère?
C'est ma tante qui fait s'occuper d'elle.
Là, là, c'est le temps de prendre soin de ton gouverne.
So that's Matthias and Maxime. Jordan, what is this about?
Yeah, so this is the latest film from French-Canadian Enfant Terrible, Xavier
Enfant
Dolan.
Enfant Terrible.
So he's actually 31 now, so I don't know if he's still he's an Enfant Terrible when you're in your 30s.
Yeah, L'Homme Terrible.
If you don't know, he's the director of Mommy, Tom at the Farm, and It's Only the End of the World. Like several of his films, Matthias and Maxime also stars Dolan as Maxime and Gabriel Delmeida Freitas as his friend of more than 20 years, Matthias. Dolan's Maxime, he's an out gay man, but as far as everyone knows, Matthias has always been and is straight. So the film opens with Matthias, Maxime and several of their friends shooting a home movie in this lake house. And the scene they're filming calls for Matthias and Maxime's characters to kiss. Mm-hmm. And this seems to reignite feelings that the pair have repressed since an event in college, which we never actually see, but we learn was romantic. And the rest of the film is essentially about these two men navigating this new dynamic. Maxime, as someone who's further along his own journey of self-identity, he's sort of ready to embrace Matthias. But Matthias is a lawyer, he's in a long-term relationship with a woman, and a lot of his identity is tied into his sexuality, which leads to some kind of incredibly charged and hostile moments. And adding pressure to this situation is the fact that Maxime is due to emigrate to Australia for 2 years in a matter of weeks, which gives the drama a kind of ticking clock. So this actually premiered at Cannes last year, which is when I first saw it. And I have to say, I went into the film with quite low expectations, because even though I think Dolan's made some exceptional films in his time, you know, Mommy is a real incredible piece of work. His last couple, It's Only the End of the World and The Life and Death of John F. Donovan, they really didn't do it for me. But if you've been following Dolan's career, you'll be glad to hear that this is a real sort of return to form for him and easily his most mature work to date. In the early scenes of the lake house, you get a lot of the Dolan tropes, kind of the overlapping dialogue, the frantic cutting, the kind of lo-fi photography, because it was shot on 16mm film using natural light. And even though Maxime himself is this shy character and he has this sort of birthmark on his face, which is a real sort of weak point for him and is a recurring theme throughout the film, you do get these gratingly shouty moments between Maxime and his mum, which threatened to like push me over the edge at points. but the film does sort of settle down after that. So there's actually very little, ultimately, the showboating and histrionics that Dolan can sometimes fall foul of. And instead, this is just a really sort of tender romance that you really feel comes from a place of honesty, because Dolan himself, of course, is a gay man, a gay filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So for me, this was his most enjoyable and watchable film for absolutely years.
He's also excellent in It.
Yeah,
Part 2. Let's not forget, he had that amazing scene, horrific scene at the beginning of Part 2. I have to say, I've sort of gone off him over the years for the reasons you said, but this does intrigue me. And I do love Call Me By Your Name, so this feels like it might be tapping into that. Do you think I'd enjoy it if I liked that sort of film?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not as swooningly romantic as Call Me By Your Name. Like, it's set in Canada, so you don't get like the nice backdrops that
Italian
you get
in that countryside.
Film. Exactly. You don't really get like the nice bike rides and stuff, but it definitely comes from a place of honesty. And for that reason alone, it felt very authentic and truthful and tender to me. Yeah, I thought it was a really impressive piece of work. It feels like a bit of a backhanded compliment to call it his most emotionally mature work to date, but I do mean that quite truthfully. I think he's grown into his position now as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, and I'm really excited to see the kind of films he makes, you know, moving on from here. Because I felt like, you know, Matt, we both saw The Life and Death of John F. Donovan together, which was his first English language film. It was a bit of a low point for me in terms of his filmography. It just felt like he was just cashing in on the fact that he has a lot of celebrity mates and, you know, Kit Harington's in it, Jessica Chastain was in it, Natalie Portman's in it. It's got all these incredible famous faces in, but it was just so full of itself and smug. It really didn't work on any level for me, but this felt like a real back to basics kind of bit of storytelling, and I thought was all the better for it.
And do you think as well, because just based on what you've said, but because it is so stripped back, do you think it will play well in these sort of like lockdown times we're living in?
I think it's a film that's perfectly suitable for watching in your living room. Films like this, which are incredibly intimate character pieces, they almost benefit from the fact you can watch them in an intimate setting like your own living room. You don't have to feel self-conscious about munching down on some popcorn while someone's sat next to you in a Curzon cinema. Like, you can just relax.
Yeah, in floods of tears, feeling everything. Yeah, you can just drink your wine and enjoy this at home in your PJs, which is how I intend to consume it this evening. That's Matthias and Maxime, which is available on Mubi from the 28th of August. Right, it's time to get away from it all with this. Okay, so that is Away. Matt, this is a nice little animation, a little diversion and adventure. Yes. Where is it taking us?
So, Away, this is a homespun kind of animated film from Latvian director Gints Zilbalodis. Sorry if I just mangled your name.
Well
there,
done.
Gints. Now, obviously, we were kind of just talking about Xavier Dolan being a bit of a prodigious wunderkind, but Zilbalodis probably deserves to be in the same category. I believe he's 25 and he spent like 4 years crafting this film pretty much single-handedly. Like, it seriously had the shortest credits I've ever seen at the end of a film. And so it's technically a Latvian film, but there's no dialogue in it and it's animated, so it's pretty universal in that sense. And it's very sort of stripped back and sort of dreamlike almost. It starts with this young boy, I'd guess around, you know, early teens perhaps, but very simple animation, very sort of simple character design. And right at the beginning, we find him hanging from a tree where his parachutes got caught and he's on this mysterious island. And before long, this giant kind of black shadowy sort of colossus-like figure is slowly trudging towards him and obviously scares him a bit. And so he kind of gets off, heads off, and he basically looks for his way to escape this mysterious island that he's landed on. And all the while he's kind of being slowly and ominously pursued by this figure, which seemingly kind of sucks the life force out of any creature it kind of gets into contact with. He befriends a little bird along the way, and early on he discovers remnants, presumably from a previous occupant on the island. There's a motorbike, there's a backpack which contains a map and a flask and things like that. And from then on he tries to find his way out, and it's separated into these different chapters called things like Forbidden Oasis and Mirror Lake, where he goes into different zones of this island, and that's how it all unfolds. Like I said, it's very stripped back, very dreamlike, no dialogue in the whole film and no sort of obvious answers, no filling in of backstories or anything like that. It's just a stripped back survival story.
It sounds reminiscent to me a little bit of The Red Turtle, the Studio Ghibli produced film. Are the two comparable at all?
Well, that was obviously the first thing that kind of jumped into my mind as well, because they are kind of comparable in that sense, I would say, but they're quite different at the same time. I'd say this is perhaps aimed a bit broader than that was. That was quite intense and adult almost, wasn't it, The Red Turtle? But this isn't quite as gritty. But yeah, they definitely would make an interesting sort of double bill. Obviously, another thing that differentiates them is that felt like quite classical hand-drawn animation. This is what I would consider like cell shading, kind of computer-generated, very simple lines, simple colours. And sometimes it kind of pushes up at the limit of what that can do, and it can look a bit, you know, rough around the edges at times. But I found it was absorbing, and it almost is kind of interesting in an experimental way of how far you can engage with something so simple. And I mean, it's only 75 minutes long, but it did retain my interest. I was hooked in. I did feel tension. I did feel like I cared about this little bird he meets along the way. And he meets a few other animals, and there's some moments of real tension with this mysterious creature. And sometimes I think it suffered from feeling a bit video gamey. The cell shaded animation sort of adds to that sometimes. And just the fact that he finds this backpack of goodies that can kind of help him on his journey, and just the nature of it, that you're following this guy from behind a lot of the time as he's traversing the different stages of this landscape, it does give it a bit of a video game feeling, but I enjoyed it.
And at 75 minutes, I mean, that feels like a something you could just dip into and sort of go on this sort of journey for a little bit without actually giving up too much of your time.
Yeah, despite us saying the moments of tension, there's something almost relaxing about it. Like, it always feels like you can just give yourself over to and just relax into it, because you're not following any dialogue and it's just all visual, and there's something sort of nice about it because you see this kind of nature. There's these, you know, bizarre plants that look like really tall, like cress plants and things like that. There obviously there's water and other things, big skies, various creatures running around, so it's always quite a nice environment to give yourself over to.
Sounds delightful. Where can we see it?
Well, this is in select cinemas from 28th of August.
Great. So that's all we have to talk about for this week. There is another film that's coming out, isn't there, Jordan?
Yeah, The New Mutants, believe it or not.
What's
is
that?
Actually yeah, I know, what is it, who knows. It's the X-Men spin-off set in an insane asylum with a hot young cast. It's finally coming out, believe it or not, on Saturday in sort of preview showings around the country. So you can actually go and see New Mutants on Saturday if you so wish. But we're not talking about it because we haven't seen it. We haven't been shown it.
Because there has been no fanfare. Nobody has told us this. We stumbled across this information. And that's not a good sign generally, is it?
Generally doesn't bode well when films aren't screened for press in advance. That's not always the case, you know. We see huge blockbusters like Avengers Endgame and The Rise of Skywalker the day before they come out. And, you know, some of them turn out to be great. But the fact that it's not being screened at all, generally, I would be a tiny bit wary.
And it was also massively delayed before the pandemic. The reason this is coming out late is nothing to do with COVID. This was put back and put back. It's actually going to be really interesting to see. Are you going to go and see it to see what the hell was going on with it?
I'm very intrigued to see it, absolutely. Not 100% sure if I'm ready to go to a public screening of it yet, because the only time I've been back to the cinema so far is in my very privileged position as a film critic, where, you know, the screening of Tenet was very sparsely attended and very well socially distanced. Whether I'm ready to sit in a cinema with an audience of 50 strangers, I'm not sure yet, but I will see it one day, I'm sure.
Are you being generous that 50 people might go and see this?
It's true. I'll be surprised if anyone knows it's actually out. I haven't seen any advertising.
I know. It's like, that's what I mean. It's like you'd have to know in order to be going to see it. Okay, but we are telling you that it is out, apparently. Go and find it if you're interested in that. And we'll hopefully be able to talk about it a little bit more when we've seen it. Okay, so that is it. Please listen to our Christopher Nolan special podcast where we're counting down all his films in ranking order. And please go and see Tenet, because then we'd like you to come back and listen to us talk about it in detail with our spoiler podcast. Okay, so for now, I want you to go and scribble down all your thoughts on Tenet, because we need to talk about every aspect of it. I'm going to go away and Google the grandfather paradox, so I think I know what I'm talking about. But for now, let's say goodbye.
Bye.
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 All I have for you is a word.
Tell it.